At the risk of repeating myself, maybe for the third or fourth time, I don't know, jobs, people. Jobs, 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 jobs. That is the whole deal right now. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 6th of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with a little cognitive economic dissonance. News item number one, the regular Thursday report on first-time claims for unemployment benefits. Last week, for the first time in 14 months, those claims fell below 500,000 people. Still historically high, but way better on trend. News item number two, the regular report on monthly unemployment we are going to get tomorrow. Could be seven figures worth of new jobs. News item three, and this one is straight up reporting that we have done. Even though fewer people are getting laid off and more people are finding jobs, we still have companies and trade groups shouting loudly and persistently, it must be said, that they just can't find people to hire. There are a bunch of reasons. Of course, people who lost or left jobs might be worried about getting sick if they go back. There are schools that some people have started. Also, of course, kids and no child care. We asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman, what else might be going on, though?
About that loud and persistent complaining that employers can't hire the workers they need, don't just take our word for it.
We simply can't source enough talent to meet current demand.
Richard Wahlquist is CEO of the American Staffing Association, which represents employment and temp agencies.
We don't expect that that's going to abate in the near future, and it's across many, many different occupations.
Wahlquist says a lot of potential workers aren't ready to get a new job yet. Maybe they're not vaccinated or have kids stuck at home. He says many older, skilled workers may not be coming back.
Baby boomers who are nearing retirement or working perhaps beyond traditional retirement, many of them have left the workforce altogether.
And so companies are recruiting loudly and persistently.
Everywhere you drive, you see help wanted signs.
Michael Gritton runs Kentuckiana Works, the workforce development board for the Louisville region.
Our career centers are hosting job fairs. Companies are offering signing bonuses.
But Gritton doesn't see this as a classic labor shortage. It's more a matter of time.
The return of workers is going to be gradual, so there's a mismatch between what employers want and the speed with which people are going to come back to the labor market.
There's another mismatch, says Heidi Shierholz at the Progressive Economic Policy Institute, between the pay employers are offering and the pay workers are willing to take.
If an employer posts a job and then they can't find the workers that they need, that just means there's a labor shortage of people who will work at that wage.
In a really tight labor market, as Fed Chair Jay Powell has recently pointed out, wages would be rising. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
We gave this one a nod yesterday that the Biden administration now supports waiving patent protections on COVID vaccines in service, as Trade Representative Catherine Tai put it, of ending this pandemic. But just lifting intellectual property protections can't by itself get more shots in more arms. Marketplace's Samantha Fields looked into that one.
One of the arguments against waiving patents on the vaccines is that patent protections are not the only thing or even the main thing standing in the way of other countries churning out more vaccine.
The waiver is the first step.
Madhavi Sundar is a professor at Georgetown University Law Center. She says, in addition,
we need these companies to share with manufacturers around the world how to make these vaccines safely and effectively. Just reading the patent isn't going to teach them.
But the prospect of a waiver, which pharmaceutical companies oppose, could be enough of a bargaining chip to get them to volunteer that information, says Nicholson Price at the University of Michigan Law School.
I could imagine the wheels being greased a little bit if this is something that's on the table now that I think the pharmaceutical industry pretty reasonably thought was effectively off the table until pretty recently.
And if not, the U.S. government does have other leverage to push companies to share their know-how, such as the fact that it has a patent that Moderna and others are using in their vaccines, says James Krellenstein at the advocacy organization Prep for All.
The U.S. government right now could basically say, hey, you're using our technology. as a condition of this, you have to transfer the technology over.
Even if all of that gets worked out, there's also the question of, are there even enough factories in the world ready and able to make these vaccines? Right now, Krellenstein says, there aren't.
But we know we can build new factories extraordinarily rapidly. There was not a single factory in the world in February of 2020 that could make mRNA vaccines at commercial scale. We built those factories.
And Krellenstein says, now it's time to build more. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, up all the way around, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're about getting to that point when companies are going to have to start getting specific with their people about what their futures are going to look like. Going to be in the office? Going to be fully remote? Going to be somewhere in between? The CEO of Google and its parent company, Alphabet, Sundar Pichai, said something in an email yesterday that stuck out to us. The future of work, Pichai said, is flexibility. Remote? Hybrid? Googlers get to decide, apparently. And work flexibility sounds great, but honestly, it kind of does apply only to certain jobs and certain industries. So we asked Marketplace's Andy Euler to get on the phone with some labor economists to see what they figure the future of work might be.
If you ask a bunch of labor experts what the future of work's going to look like, most are reluctant to commit.
The future of work is uncertain.
I would say the future of work is in flux.
The future of work is not predetermined.
Those vagaries came from Carl Van Horn at Rutgers, Alex Colvin at Cornell, and Jesse Hammerling at California Berkeley. And they did elaborate. Let's start with Van Horn.
The uncertainty has to do with not only people's behavior, but also employers.
That's uncertainty about vaccine rules at the office or whether working from home is an employee benefit. Alex Colvin at Cornell says the word flexibility is just the right amount of vague for a company like Google with about 140,000 workers.
Does flexibility mean we can get rid of labor costs when we need to, employees are more disposable? Or does flexibility mean flexibility in what we're doing at work, how we do the work? Both those are flexibility, but they mean very different things to workers.
And Jesse Hammerling, who studies the future of work at UC Berkeley, says those who have to do their jobs in person at restaurants, hospitals, grocery stores usually make less than people who can work from home. And COVID only brought more attention to this inequality in the labor market.
It's really important that workers have a voice and have power in shaping what the future of work will be if we want to get ourselves off our current path that leads toward more low-paid, low-road jobs.
She says after the pandemic, worker complaints about their jobs aren't simply about low wages, but about job quality as well. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
You know who's still working at home? David Brancaccio and the gang on the Marketplace Morning Report. At home, but still bringing you the business and economic news you need to start your day. Check it out. Tens of millions of people have spent way more time at home this past year than they usually do. And that, in turn, has gotten a lot of us thinking way more about the work of managing a household. Childcare, for sure, but also cooking, sewing, maybe, and a whole raft of other things you might have covered in a middle school home ec class. What you might not know is that home economics changed the way we live. It also opened the doors to a lot of professional opportunities for women. Danielle Dreilinger's new book on the topic at hand is called The Secret History of Home Economics. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So I'm going to tell you right now, I saw this come across my desk and I said, home ec? Really? I can't be the only person in the course of writing this book who said that to you.
Oh, absolutely. And I thought going into it, oh, this is the class that taught girls how to cook.
Right.
But then I started doing research into the topic. And the first thing I learned was that like everything that we thought about home economics was wrong.
Well, I should tell you, just in full disclosure, I think my mother still has an apron that I made in home ec when I was in sixth grade. I don't know. She's gonna email me and tell me. Anyway, let's get to the substance of this book, which, first of all, it goes back you know, 100 and something years the history of this does. But it was actually the stress here is on economics with home as just the environment, right?
Right. So the home economists of the founding era had two priorities. One was to bring science into the home so that women could get their work done with less time so that they would have time for more things like studying or paid employment, taking care of their kids, anything. But on top of that, I think that home economists were really unique for many decades in recognizing that the work done in the home had important economic value.
But there were, I mean, corporate America did eventually see value in these home economists and hired them and put them to work in product development and all of that.
Right. And in fact, usually in many companies, the first woman in the top levels of management was a home economist. Starting certainly in 1920, if not earlier, there became this range of jobs and like marketing departments and advertising targeting women as consumers. And home economists got deeply involved in this on all ends. I mean, Betty Crocker, who was fictional, had a team of home economists behind her. So businesses absolutely understood the value that home economists brought.
How then did it go from this tangible value add thing? And I'm going to get in trouble here because of the turn I'm going to make. It went from this tangible thing to teaching girls in schools how to cook. Not that there's not value in that, but you know what I mean.
Right, right. Well, so there's a few points with this. One is that there was always a tension in home economics over whether this was oppression or whether it was liberation. The founding home economists really pushed for the empowerment possibilities in their field, but they were also working with a lot of people, mostly men, who thought that this was all a great way to teach women, especially women of color, to be wives and mothers and maids. The field rebranded in the 90s. What they call themselves is mostly family and consumer sciences. At last count, more than 3 million middle and high school students in U.S. public schools took home economics each year.
Wow. I honestly had no idea. Okay, but to the future then, you make the case at the end of this book that we ought to just bring back home economics, own it, as it were, call it what it is, and even though women don't need these back doors to get into science, like textile science or chemical engineering, we ought to just call it home ec and move on.
Right. So I didn't go into this project intending to become an advocate for home economics, but I think it matters because, what we saw a year ago, the pandemic lockdowns begin, and all sorts of companies are just thinking that their employees can work full time from home while the schools are closed because we don't recognize the value and the inescapability of the work of the home. And the work of the home matters. It's work.
Danielle Dreilinger, her most recent book is called The Secret History of Home Economics. Totally fascinating. Danielle, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Coming up.
I don't think anybody ever looked at a QR code and thought, oh, this is super cool.
Yeah, I totally believe that. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 318 points today, 0.9%, 34,548, a record high. I'm obliged to add here. The NASDAQ up 50 points, 0.5%, 0.3%, 13,632. The S&P 500 ticked up 34 points, 0.8%, finished things at 4,201. Samantha Fields was telling us about vaccine patents. So, checking in on big pharma companies. Moderna reported its first official profits ever, $1.2 billion. In the black, shares, though, shot down 1.4%. Shot down. Get it? Moderna? That was pretty good. Pfizer, down almost 1%. Johnson & Johnson gained 0.4%. Today, I talked about Google and its flexible work policy. Parent company Alphabet shares up almost 1%. Bonds up as well. Yield on the 10-year T-note, 1.57%. You're listening to Marketplace. Marketplace makes it easy for you to decode the black box of this economy. And right now, we're making it even easier to support the public service journalism that you value. When you donate just $5 a month right now, you're not only joining our community of Marketplace investors, but you also have your choice of thank you gifts. So please support the nonprofit news you trust at marketplace.org/donate. And thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Amy Scott did a story for us, must be a couple of months ago now, about how big cash buyers are coming into a lot of real estate markets and snapping up available homes. That is still happening. And in some of the most expensive places in the country, looking at you, San Francisco Bay Area, it makes it almost impossible for regular people to compete. Now, though, there is a law in California meant to even the playing field a bit. From KQED, Molly Solomon reports.
The single-story house is tan with brown trim. It sits on a quiet residential street with a steep, sloping backyard. And it's the place Jocelyn Foreman calls home.
This is my room right here.
The house she rents is in the East Bay city of Pinole, a suburb outside of San Francisco.
And then that room is my daughter's room where my grandson is. And then her twin lives in the other room.
For the better part of the last 20 years, Foreman says she and her children were homeless and couch surfing with relatives. It wasn't until she moved into this house more than 2 years ago that she finally had stability. That is, until she found a notice on the door. Her landlord had lost the home to foreclosure, and it was set for sale at an auction.
Like, the first thing that I thought was, where am I going to sleep? Whose house can I call?
But a new California law gives tenants of foreclosed properties 45 days to find the money to match a winning bid when foreclosed properties go to auction. So Foreman set out to test that new law. She went to the auction for the house she lives in. It was early March. She says there were a handful of people in plastic chairs, clutching folders and holding cell phones. The bidding began at $175,000. It ended at $600,000. Much more than Foreman could possibly match.
And I said, oh my goodness, you know, a little bit of me felt like this was going to happen.
The winning bidder was Wedgwood, a Southern California real estate company that flips thousands of homes every year. Greg Geiser is the company's founder and CEO.
If we make money on our efficiency, on what we do. We typically make money on our rehab because we can do it better, quicker, faster, and cheaper than somebody else.
But last year, Wedgwood bought one really controversial house in Oakland. A group of black homeless mothers occupied the house and staged a protest to shine a light on increasing corporate home ownership, which they said has led to rising rents and growing homelessness. They called themselves Moms for Housing. The protest ended in January last year when the moms were evicted and Wedgwood agreed to sell the house to a community land trust. That controversy also sparked debate in the legislature that resulted in the new state law that went into effect this year. Kevin Stein is the deputy director of the California Reinvestment Coalition. He says the new law
was an effort to kind of open the door, to create an opportunity for families, for tenants, to attain wealth through home ownership.
But the law didn't include any money to help people like Foreman buy those foreclosed houses. And it hasn't stopped companies like Wedgwood from buying up homes. Since the law went into effect, property records show Wedgwood alone has bought more than 100 homes across California. Almost all of them were paid in cash, and most were single-family homes, just like Foreman's house in Pinole. Eventually, Foreman was able to buy the house and celebrated at a recent public signing of her contract with the community land trust that bought the property. That land trust helped her raise the money, along with the assistance of an online fundraising campaign, to match Wedgwood's bid. Foreman will work out a financing deal to ensure that she can afford the monthly payments on the house.
This house was so important to me. It was my opportunity to break cycles for myself and for my children. I am beyond words right now.
But advocates say for the new law to be truly effective, the state will need to fund it so that more families, like Foreman's, can compete with real estate entities one house at a time. In Berkeley, I'm Molly Solomon for Marketplace.
You might have noticed as this pandemic wore on and on last year, and people and businesses were looking for more and better ways to go contactless, you might have noticed the explosion of QR codes, those black and white square-looking things. Quick response is what that QR stands for. That you can scan with your phone, and presto, the menu comes up for the restaurant you're in. I used one at a bike rental place last summer. They are kind of everywhere. And businesses are figuring QR codes are going to be mainstream long after this pandemic is over and done with. Marketplace's Scott Tong took a trip to Philadelphia.
At the corner of 15th and Chestnut in Philadelphia, there's a construction site. But instead of a fancy architectural sketch of what's going up, life-sized QR codes, 6 feet by 6 feet, are printed on the wall. Scan them with your phone, and you learn that the W Hotel is coming to this block. Rob Reed at the ad agency One Trick Pony thought up the idea while he was eating at a restaurant. There were QR codes on the table to pull up the menu.
I scanned it with my phone. I didn't realize the camera automatically kicked to their webpage. And I saw the menu, and I was like, man, this is, like, genius. Like, we used to make fun of them before.
Of the dozens of QR codes on the wall here, one has a Spotify logo embedded.
If you scan that one, it goes right to their playlist.
The W team had a local DJ create the list, with tracks from the likes of Roisin Murphy and Leon Bridges. It's meant to tease a young, trendy vibe. And then if you scan the QR code that includes an Instagram logo, up pops an Instagram video of 20-something personal trainers who will be running fitness classes at the hotel. Hotels use QR codes for more than just marketing, says the W's general manager, Ed Baton.
We've been using the QR codes for everything from check-in experiences to communicate within our guest rooms, our in-room dining menus, even using QR codes that will allow them to use their iPhone device as a remote control for the TV.
By one estimate, the hotel industry's adoption of QR codes grew sevenfold in the pandemic. Now, these codes go back to the 90s, and until recently, many declared them dead, at least for consumer use. Jasper Radicke is with the mobile marketing firm AppsFlyer.
QR codes for a while were seen as somewhat uncool. I don't think anybody ever looked at a QR code and thought, oh, this is super cool.
Let's face it, they're literally square. Now, a few years ago, you needed a special phone app to read QR codes. But now, iPhone and Android cameras come with built-in QR readers. And it's cheap and easy to make the codes, which took off in the pandemic.
All of a sudden, there was also a function that was not just a gimmick. That's what the pandemic added to this. The move towards contactless, and also the questions around, how do I get information to the people in the restaurant?
National pharmacy chains and Walmart offer QR codes at the checkout. Doctors' offices put them in emails to get patient information. It pretty much took 25 years for this technology to go big. And that's not uncommon, says economist and historian Petra Moser at NYU. The process for making modern rubber, for instance, came in the 1840s.
When Charles Goodyear invented vulcanization, people just really didn't know what to do with it. All the things that we use rubber for today, they were not invented yet.
Like the automobile. The Model T came around 7 decades later. Penicillin took 20 years after invention to get mass-produced. So, will the QR code have a long run? At the hotel school at Cornell, consumer psychologist Helen Chun can think of future uses.
You are dining at a hotel restaurant. There's this nice wine that you are enjoying, and there is a QR code on the wine bottle, and you scan it, and then you can book directly to visit this winery.
Or a hotel can tailor a QR code to a specific customer and include information on how to get hypoallergenic pillows or find the nearest vegetarian restaurant, things that are highly relevant to guests. But at the corner of 15th and Chestnut, relevance is the question. Are these gigantic QR codes catching the eye of pedestrians? I waited an hour there and didn't see a single person scanning. It might have been the wrong hour, but Chen says the key is any new digital thing can't just be a gimmick. It has to deliver something valuable. In Philadelphia, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
That's dedication, man, waiting around for an hour to see if somebody scans that thing. Scott made a QR code for us. Links to our Spotify playlist of the music that you hear on this show. That QR code is in his story, which is, of course, at marketplace.org. Final note on the way out today. Hey, you hungry? Got anything to eat? Maybe a snack nearby? More of us do, says Kellogg's. Have snacks nearby, that is. On CNBC this morning, the CEO said the economy opening up has not reversed our pandemic snackage. Snacking has not slowed down, he said. In fact, snacking has sped up, which I personally feel. All right, we got to go, but here is your moment of economic context. Looping back to Mitchell's story that we started with, jobs and the companies that need people to fill them. The National Federation of Independent Businesses, which is basically the small business lobbying group, was out with a report today that said 44% of small business owners say they have openings they can't fill. That 44% is 22 points higher than the historical average over the past half century. So a lot. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, Diantha Parker, Beth Perlman, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.